Let's turn in our Bibles to Luke's Gospel, chapter 5. Last week, we picked up on our study in verses 12 through 16, which is Luke's record of the healing of a leper that came to Jesus. One of the very few records in the Gospels of a healing of a leper. There are no records in the book of Acts of any lepers being healed. There are only about 7 references to lepers in the New Testament, and several of those are simply repetitious recordings of the same story. Leprosy, in our study last week, we discovered was the pinnacle persuasion when Moses wanted to know how the people of Israel would accept his word that he was come to deliver them. He had a staff that would turn into a snake when he threw it on the ground. But the more compelling sign was when he put his hand into his bosom and brought it out, and it was leprous. And then he put it back in and brought it out, and it was clean. So the lesser sign was the staff turning into a snake, and the greater sign was the leprosy. And in our study last time, we saw that there is a deliberate parallelism in Luke's record where John comes on the scene talking about snakes and God's ability to take them and turn them into heirs of his kingdom. It's kind of like grabbing the snake by the tail and it turns into a staff. It's a conversion of the snake into something else. And then, of course, the healing of the leper comes right in here after John's ministry is over and Jesus's has begun. At any rate, in our study last time, we looked particularly at the prayer that the leper prayed in verse 12, when he came to Jesus and said, "Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean." We looked into the leper's motivation, his desperation, his theology, and whether he is in fact an example for us. And in a very real sense, he is an example for us in a limited sort of way. The outer boundaries of his example are two. He had a problem that Jesus could handle, and he knew it. And he brought this problem to Jesus to see if Jesus was willing to handle it the way the leper wanted it handled. And that was why he said, "You're able if you're willing. You can make me clean if you're willing." So the leper, in that sense, is an illustration for us all, because we can bring our request to God and ask him if he will deal with things the way we want him to. And we understand that he can. It's just that we don't know if he will. So in that respect, the leper serves as an example for us. But for 2 weeks now, we've attempted to make this point from this paragraph, that conditional discipleship is not discipleship at all. We noticed that Jesus got his first 3 disciples in the first 11 verses, and then in chapter 5, verse 12 through 16, he immediately goes into this issue of a person with a massive problem and the ambiguity that is attached to his problem in relation to the way he views Jesus. You can, if you're willing. That's ambiguous. And the issue, of course, in connection with the preceding paragraph, seems to me to be that he is telling us that one of the major discipleship issues is going to be those times when God does not do what we want him to, the way we want him to. And the question then is, are you going to be his disciple anyway? And so I've tried for 2 weeks now to make that point, that conditional discipleship is not really discipleship at all. It may be the greatest problem that men have in thinking that they have this ability to negotiate with God over discipleship. It may be the greatest problem that men have of all the problems they face, that they think they have a right to negotiate with God in respect to the issue of discipleship. They seem to think they have the right to insist not only upon certain outcomes for their participation with God, but also upon certain processes. We as human beings tend to think that we have a right to insist that if we're going to be his disciples, then certain things have to happen, and they have to happen a certain way. But that, in effect, is saying, if you will agree to my preset issues, I'll serve you. And that's really a rather blatant contradiction of three of God's characteristics: his knowledge, his wisdom, and his love. Men who condition their discipleship are, in effect, saying, if you will subject your knowledge, your wisdom, and your love to mine, then I'll serve you. And it never seems to enter their minds or their brains that that's what they're saying. Whenever you ask somebody if they're going to be willing to be a disciple of Jesus, if they don't come back with a yes, no buts, then they've automatically already said, well, I'm not sure I'm ready for that. Why? Well, because there are certain things I want, and I want them to happen a certain way, and if God's not going to cooperate with that, then I'll just do it myself. And that's subjecting his wisdom, his knowledge, and his love to ours. So it just never seems to enter most human beings' brains that discipleship is not a negotiable thing. It's not negotiated. You don't enter into a contract. Israel discovered that entering into a contract is dead end straight. But this morning, it is going to enter our brains. What we do with it is up to us, but we're going to at least face it today. We're going to do this by looking at Luke's record again, and we're going to look particularly at Jesus' response to the leper's prayer. We're going to zero in on Jesus' response. If you're willing, you can make me clean. Verse 13 says, and having stretched out his hand, he touched him, saying, I'm willing, be cleansed. And immediately the leprosy left him. In order for this to have the kind of focus that I decided on pursuing, I'm going to deal with Jesus' answer to the statement, if you're willing, you can make me clean, in light of both of the things that he did. But I'm going to start with the second thing that he did, and then we'll go back to the first thing to wind up our study. The second thing he did was he said, I am willing, be cleansed. And the leprosy was gone, just like that. It's gone. So when we look at this statement, I am willing, be cleansed, we know that Jesus, in the first place, Luke says, he said, lego, I say. Which that word means that he's going to unload some pretty significant truth. There's more than one word for speaking in the Bible. And one of them emphasizes the noise that's made. And the other one emphasizes the content that comes out of the noise. This is the one that emphasizes the content. And when Jesus said that, I am willing, be cleansed, he is dealing with some very fundamental things. And it's interesting that he, when he said that, blended the leper's theology. The leper came to Jesus with a theology of power, you can, but he was compromised in his conviction at the level of whether Jesus would, and Jesus blended it. He said, I am willing. That handled the leper's question about his willingness. And then he did what he asked, and it was instantaneous. It was done. So Jesus, in his statement, blended the leper's thinking about the power and the willingness. And that's the first part of the second part of Jesus' response. The second part of the second part is this. He created an enormous difficulty for everyone who either was there to witness it or has witnessed it since in the record of the scriptures. He created an enormous difficulty. You say, what difficulty? I mean, he gave the guy what he asked. His leprosy was cleansed instantly. And I want to say this about this difficulty. The difficulty was temporarily obliterated by the tidal wave of the event. I mean, here comes this tsunami of powerful willingness that takes a leper and instantaneously cleanses him. That is such an enormously powerful thing that anybody that witnessed would have been absolutely blown over by it. if I can mix my metaphors from tsunamis to winds. I mean, it was like this huge wave of the powerful willingness of Jesus just washes over everybody when they see this leper cleansed. But then, like it always does, water seeks its own level and the tide goes back out. And there on the beach is this huge problem. What is it? Well, the problem is this. The question, what made Jesus willing at this moment in time with this leper and not countless other moments of time with countless other lepers, not to even mention all of those with lesser problems? Does that bother anybody but me? Does anybody here suppose that this was the first time the leper ever sought divine relief from his leprosy? You suppose he'd never gone to God in prayer up till this particular point in time and said, God, I know you're powerful enough. Are you willing to cleanse me? You think this is the first time you ever said that? I don't know about you, but if I were a leper, I'd be asking for some divine solutions pretty regular. I mean, even the Apostle Paul had what he called a thorn in the flesh, which wasn't anything as significant as leprosy. And he says he asked God three times to get rid of that. So I just have my doubts as to whether this was the first time this leper ever brought this problem to God. And in addition to that, do you suppose that this is the only leper in the world who ever asked God for cleansing? I hope you're beginning to see a little bit of the difficulty that Jesus created when he healed this guy. Because the question is, why was Jesus willing to heal this leper at this point in time in history and not heal him either earlier or heal all those other lepers that were running around in Israel that had also prayed? This is one of the issues of dealing with God and the issue of what he does in response to prayer. I believe that Jesus actually not only created an enormous difficulty by doing this for this one guy at this one point in history, but I think he also forced everybody to begin to think about one most fundamental issue, and that is, how do we determine the truth about the character of God and his attitude toward us in light of the fact that the leper had a real problem with the question of his attitude? He didn't have a problem with his power. You can if you're willing. But he had a huge problem with whether God's attitude was positive enough that he would be willing to respond, especially since this wasn't probably the first time that he'd been asked. And I'm sure he wasn't the only leper that had ever asked and gone away still just as full of leprosy after praying as he had before. This is the thing that's sitting on the beach after the water goes back out. I mean, it's great to talk about Jesus cleansing a leper because the leper comes in desperation, falls on his face in front of him and says, if you're willing, you can make me clean. And Jesus says, well, I am willing, be clean. I mean, that's great, especially if you're the leper. But what do you do afterwards if you're a leper and you still got yours? And you say, oh, he asked for cleansing. I can ask God for cleansing. So you ask and you're not cleansed. Happens all the time, folks. All the time. The children of God ask God for things, for deliverance and relief, and they get nothing except silence from heaven in respect to it. Now, I'm not castigating. I'm not saying they should, or that God's failed in some way. What I'm saying is Jesus forced us to think about this. He probably forced lepers to think about it more than he is forcing us, because as far as I know, none of us are lepers here this morning. But every one of us has had, on occasion, certain things that we've asked God about, and we even have this statement, you know, God answers all prayers. He either says yes, no, or wait a while. What is that? Oh, that's just a way to get around the problem of asking God for something that's really important to you and not getting it. That's how we get around it. We say, well, he said no, or maybe later. Does that make you feel good? Or do you wonder, what did this leper have that I don't have? I think that Jesus was deliberately forcing a fundamental question. How do we decide the truth about the character of God and his attitude toward us? I want to ask another question. Is God's character and his attitude toward us determined by the blend of our experiences and our understanding? Do we decide what God's attitude toward us is based on what we experience and what we understand? Is that legitimate? Well, let me, before you answer that, let me just tell you that Satan's response to that is, yes, yes, yes! Determine what God is like and what he thinks about you by what you're experiencing in relation to your understanding. Yes! Do that! Because if you do, he'll have you. Most human beings agree with that. Yeah, I decide what God's like and what his attitude toward me is by what I'm experiencing and what I understand. But you know, the fact is that's a huge lie. And it goes back to the delusion I mentioned in the introduction. That I can decide without omniscience. I can decide without divine wisdom. And I can decide without the enormous love of God what God's really like based on how I'm being treated by him. Most human beings believe that, and it's a lie. It's an enormously destructive lie. But, you know, there are 6.7 billion people on the planet now, and I'll almost guarantee that 6.65 or 69 billion of them think that, yeah, it's legitimate to decide what God's like and what his attitude toward you is based on what you're experiencing. But the fact is that God's character and attitude never changes. He is immutable. And the second fact is that God's plans arise from this immutable character and attitude. And that means a couple of things that we need to be seriously aware of. When God's plans arise out of his character and his attitudes, that means that what God intends and actually accomplishes in bringing his plan to pass by implementing all of the details of his plans, I mean, he's got lots of plans, but they're all under the plan. That means that whatever God intends and does is being accomplished by all of these various things that are happening, and because the end is the result of all of these things that God is doing in his creation, it is a fact that God does one thing one day and another thing another day. And men often erroneously conclude that there is no rhyme or reason to that. It just appears that he's like we are. We make decisions one way one day and another way another day. And so God makes decisions the same way, and it makes him subject to the impression of whimsy. What do I do today, God says. Well, you have to understand that if God is omniscient and has all this wisdom and is love, as the scriptures declare, among other attributes too, that the end result of all of the things that he does, that he allows to be done, that take place in his universe, all of the things that take place in his universe are part of the plan. And that means that he will make decisions today because of the necessity of the plan. And tomorrow he'll make a different decision about a very similar thing because the plan has moved another step forward from yesterday to today. It is not whimsy. When I said men get the impression that God is whimsical in his decision making, he heals this leper, but he doesn't heal that one. And by the way, do you remember the story of Jesus being approached by a Syrophoenician woman whose daughter was demon-possessed? She was a Gentile, not a Jew. And she was a woman, not a man. And she came to Jesus and said, "My daughter has a demon, and I would like for you to cast the demon out of her." And you know what Jesus said? "It's not right to take the children's food and give it to the dogs." That's what he said. He didn't say that to this leper. That was a very blatant, in-your-face insult to that woman. Because she was a Gentile, and the Jews had always called Gentiles dogs, and she knew it. And when Jesus said, "You're asking me to take the bread of the children, the exorcism of demons for the children of Israel, and apply it to your daughter. It's not right to give the children's food to the dogs." And she could have done like 6.69999 billion of the people on this planet would have done. She could have gotten angry with his insult, turned around and walked away. "Well, just forget it then." She didn't. She said, "That's true, Lord, but even the dogs get to run around under the table and get whatever the kids drop." And Jesus said, "For that answer, go your way. Your daughter's free of the demon." So when we read the scriptures, we read what looks like whimsy. It looks like God's doing one thing one time, another. There's no consistency. There's no pattern. But that's just an impression. What is an impression? Well, impressions invariably are developed by the individuals that are developing them, who are invariably ignorant of the magnitude of the divine knowledge, the divine wisdom, the divine program, and they have little or no grasp of the impact that the decision that they're asking for will have down line. You know, we have in our conversation these days, after the development of the industrial age and now the computer age, we have this little line that's called the law of unintended consequences. What does that mean? It means people do things and they don't have any idea what's going to happen, and then when it happens they say, "Oh, I didn't mean that to happen." That's the law of unintended consequences. What's it mean? It means people are too dumb to know what's going to happen but based on what they've chosen to do. That's all it means. When I say dumb, I just mean they're not omniscient. We're all that way. How do you know what's going to happen based on what you've done? So when you ask God about something, are you asking Him to do something that you know down line what will happen if He does it? Do you know what most people say if you ask them that question? They don't care. "I've got leprosy here. I want to be cleansed." Well, what will the cleansing of your leprosy do 2,000 years from now in Lincolnton, North Carolina? I don't care. I've got leprosy. I want to be clean. And not only that, but even the care that we have is very typically very limited to our own interests. So one of the things we have to keep in mind is that we have to understand that impressions are immediately suspect. When we decide what God is like and what His attitude toward us is, we need to be very, very careful that we hold whatever impressions we are drawing as suspect, because even Solomon, who Jesus said was the wisest man who had ever lived before Jesus came, said two things. I want you to look at them. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Now, I don't develop much of my theology from Ecclesiastes. I think that's pretty dangerous because Ecclesiastes is a book that was written with a lot of statements by this man, Solomon. And his conclusion was everything's vanity. And you got to be careful with that kind of stuff. I mean, this is part of the Word of God, and properly understood, it's a legitimate part. But the things that Ecclesiastes says in chapter 3 and chapter 8 don't fall into the realm of real debate. He said in chapter 3, verse 14, here's what Solomon says, "I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it. There's nothing to take from it. God has so worked that men should fear him. That includes the healing of the leper, folks. And then I want you to go over to chapter 8 and look at what he says in verse 17. He says in verse 17, I saw every work of God. I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover, and though the wise men should say, I know, he cannot discover. I saw what God was doing, and I concluded that nobody knows what God is doing. Now, given the fact that what God does, he does forever, you can't add to it, you can't take from it, and that by being in the midst of the work and seeing what God does now, you better be very careful what you decide about who he is, what he's like, and what his attitude toward you is, because Solomon said you can't know that. Why not? Well, there's another fact. God's character and attitudes are immutable. His plans arise from his plan, which arises from his character and attributes and attitudes. And the third fact is that we experience his plan one increment at a time without either his omniscience or his love, and any theology that's developed out of that experience of ignorance is foolish beyond measure. You experience one thing at one point in time and try to develop your theology about God and his attitude toward you from that experience, and the chances of you being right are, as one guy said, slim to none, and Slim just left the building. I heard that yesterday. I thought it was pretty cute. It was in the mouth of a liberal politician type, but nonetheless, I still thought it was cute. The truth is, we experience God's plan one bit at a time. Let me see if I can give you an illustration of that. This podium is made out of some kind of plywood with an oak veneer on it. And the reason why my hand stopped when I hit it like that is because wood has molecules and atoms that bounce around in there, but they bounce so close together that there's no room for the atoms and molecules in my hand to go through them. So they resist it because they're so close together and they're vibrating so rapidly that they simply won't let my hand go through. That wasn't true with Jesus' resurrection body because he just could go right through the wall. But the fact is, those atoms and those molecules that are right there in that piece of wood where it keeps my hand from going through, at one time, about 6,000 years ago, were molecules that were in a blade of grass that one of those great big dinosaurs ate. Stay with me here. And that great big dinosaur ate that molecule right there that was in a piece of grass, and he chewed it up and swallowed it, and then he got blindsided by a bunch of hunters that were sneaking up on him, and they killed him. And they took him home and cut him up into pieces of meat and ate it. And that molecule right there turned into a piece of one of those hunters' bodies. And that guy lived for 800 and some years, and then he died. And when he died, that molecule right there went back into the ground as a piece of dirt. But it had something in it that some plant needed. So one day when there was a plant growing, one of the roots reached out and grabbed that molecule and said, that'll make my flower bloom. So it grabbed it and sucked it up into its body and made the flower bloom. And after the flower bloomed, it dried up and the wind blew. And there went that molecule flying over there in that leaf or that petal of that flower, and it landed in another place. And the story goes on and on. But at one point, that molecule was picked up by the root of an oak tree. And now it's a part of my pulpit. And has been now for 3.5 years. Does anybody know where that molecule is going to be and what its contribution to my life is going to be 10 years from now? No. Now, kids especially, you know I'm telling you a story. It's not really true. That molecule wasn't eaten by dinosaurs. Okay, it's just an illustration. My point is, that's the way we are in God's creation. This universe is enormously huge. As individuals, we're probably of the same size in terms of as that molecule is to us, if we were to compare ourselves to God. But that doesn't make me insignificant. It just makes me a part of His creation and a part of His work and a part of His plan. And just like that hunter that killed that dinosaur did not know that he was providing a way for us to have a pulpit in this room this morning, 6,000 years later. He didn't know that. It's an unintended consequence of the accuracy of his weapon when he killed that dinosaur. Now, what I'm trying to say is, when we approach the infinite God with His wisdom, His understanding, His love, and then we decide based on what He has done right now, today, in this setting, that we know what His character is like and what His attitude toward us is like based on what we're experiencing, we are being foolish beyond measure. And not only that, but let's think about this leper. He wanted Jesus to heal him. He wanted to make him clean. So Jesus did. What was really accomplished there? He lived clean for maybe 30 or 40 more years, and then he died. His body got eaten up by worms and turned back into dirt, and worms were worse than leprosy. What was really accomplished here? The fact is that physical healing, and even if you couple physical healing with emotional healing, you know that both of those things are meaningless if it is in the context of spiritual alienation. If this leper did not become an unqualified disciple, his cleansing, the impact of it was mitigated greatly. It diminished significantly. Jesus didn't heal this leper so he could be clean for the next 40 years. Physical healing, even when you get emotional healing coupled with it, if it's in the context of a lack of discipleship, there's still spiritual alienation going on. If that's true, then the physical and the emotional are basically fruitless, meaningless phenomena. And you know that the fact is, spiritual alienation exists everywhere. Conditional discipleship exists. Everywhere. If I am unwilling to be committed as a disciple without precepts, I am still alienated from my Father, at least to some degree in some areas. And as long as that's the case, my life is impoverished by my refusal to get close enough to Him to discover what He's really like. The final fact is that God has spoken in words and in history in as plain a set of terms as possible about His character and His attitudes toward us. And the real issue is whether men are going to believe the testimony of the Scriptures instead of what they're experiencing. I know Job's not a good guy to use as an illustration in many respects because we don't identify with him. James used Job as an illustration, but ever since James did that, people said, well, I'm not Job. But just think about what Job's theology was like when he was deciding what God's attitude toward him was based on what his experiences were. He decided that God was mistreating him, that the judge of all the earth was not being fair. He decided a lot of things, and his friends made even worse decisions. Based on what? His experiences. What would have happened if instead of his experiences, he would have stayed on target with his theology about God? Now, he didn't drift too badly, and God did bring him back. That's the book of Job. But do you know that the book of Job was written because it is a challenge to the question of whether you believe that God loves you, regardless of what's happening in your life? That's why it was written. Job is one of the three wisdom books in the Old Testament, and it was written as a compliment to Paul's summary that there abides faith, hope, and love, these three, and the greatest of these is love. Well, faith is the book of Proverbs, hope is the book of Ecclesiastes, and love is the book of Job. And the question of the book of Job is, are you going to love him because he loves you, or are you going to let your circumstances decide how you're going to respond to him based on what you think those circumstances are telling you about his attitude toward you? What if you're wrong? What are the chances you'll be wrong if you use your experiences to determine your theology? So the second thing that Jesus did when he addressed this leper's request was he gave him what he asked for, but when he did that, he created all kinds of problems for all the rest of us. When we ask and don't get what we're asking for, and, you know, some of the things we ask for we shouldn't be asking for anyway, they're so silly, but they're not silly to the asker. But there are some things we ask about that are absolutely crucial for our lives. We're devastated by some things that happen, and we turn to God with request. Now, in all fairness, God often does exactly what we ask. That's not the problem. The problem is when he doesn't. That's the problem that was created here. He did for this leper what he wanted. But what about all those other lepers? And what about all those other times this leper had prayed and not gotten the answer? Why was it so important at this particular time that he got his cleansing and not yesterday and the day before that? In a sentence or two, the answer to that is Jesus didn't cleanse that leper to cleanse that leper. Jesus cleansed that leper to demonstrate who he was so that people could come to believe that he was the Son of God. That's why he did it. You think I'm mistaken, you just read on into Matthew chapter, I think it's 11, where John the Baptist is in jail, and he's beginning to get a little shaky about whether or not Jesus is the one. And so he sends some of his disciples, and they say, John sent us to ask you, are you the one, or should we be looking for somebody else? And Jesus doesn't even answer them. He turns and he starts healing people. He does all these works, just while these guys are watching. And he says, now, you've seen the blind healed. You've seen this dead person raised. You've seen this leper cleansed. You go back and tell John what you've seen. Because, see, those things were in Isaiah's prophecy about what Messiah would do. And he said, and by the way, tell him, blessed is he that is not stumbled by me or over me. And I know, because John was a man of God and a man of the Scriptures, that when he heard those things, he said, how could I have doubted? That's why Jesus did it. You say, oh, you mean that leper didn't get cleansed because he was a leper and he wanted to be cleansed? No, he got cleansed because John needed to have his courage reinforced. You see, God does all kinds of things to accomplish all kinds of ends. And you have to be really, really careful that you don't decide that he did this to accomplish that because he might have done this to accomplish that. And if you misunderstand, then your theology will be broken. So that's the first thing Jesus did, and it helps us to understand this issue of discipleship in the midst of ambiguity, where often we do get exactly what we ask from God, and sometimes we don't. And when we don't, we do not change our theology because he turned us down. Now I want us to work our way back to the first part of his answer. It says in verse 13 that Jesus' first response to the leper's request was, having stretched out his hand, he touched him. Jesus touched the leper. When he did that, he broke all of the legal and cultural norms regarding leprosy. When God gave the law to Israel through Moses, he did so with an omniscience-based understanding of every single process in the entire universe. He knew when that dinosaur ate that blade of grass that Pastor Klein was going to turn it into a pulpit 6,000 years later. He knew that. God knew that. I didn't. Nobody else did. But God did. he gave his law to Moses with that kind of understanding of every process in his entire universe. And this means that because God knows exactly what the entire downline impact will be from everything that he does, and Ecclesiastes says, whatever he does forever, there is for God no such thing as the law of unintended consequences. There is not. He knows. He operates on the basis of his knowledge. And that means also then that when he gave the law about leprosy to Israel, he understood exactly the processes of communicable diseases that it took men. Do you know that if you went to the hospital 200 years ago, you were as liable to die as if you never even went? Why? Well, they had this thing called cross communication of infection. What was causing that? Doctors. They would work on this person, get the crud and junk all over their hands working on this person, and then they'd wipe it off on a rag and go over to the next person. They didn't know that you passed infection that way. God did. And so he told the nation of Israel, when you come to a leper, you don't touch. You stay away. And if you touch him, you're unclean, and you can't be cleansed until you've washed in running water and a few other things. He knew. It took men 6,000 years to figure it out. I had a friend. He's dead now. He's a young man, 27, 28 years old. I've mentioned him to you before. He had cancer. But they were going to try this treatment on him where they kill all the bone marrow in your bones, and then they re-inject some bone marrow that doesn't have cancer cells in it so that you can grow it back. That is such a touchy process, because when they kill all that bone marrow, you're wide open for infection. Wide open. Nothing in your body can stand against any kind of infection. So they put you in this room that's supposed to be absolutely sterile, and they even have a fan above the ceiling of that room so that when the door opens, the fan starts blowing air from the room out the door. So that if you're standing in the door, the air is blowing all your germs out the door. Because they know if this guy gets contacted with any germ, he's dead. He doesn't have the ability to defend himself. That's a rather late development in medical science. When did they start blowing the door, the germs out the door with a fan in medical processes in our world? Well, within the last, 20, 30 years? How come it's taken us so long to figure out what God already knew? Because he's omniscient, we're not. So when we say that the law was given to Israel with all the understanding God knew, he told the people, don't touch a leper. But why did he tell them not to? The intention was to protect everybody who would get leprosy from somebody who already had it. That's why he gave it. How could Jesus reach out and touch this guy? He was breaking the law, was he? No. Because the law is not just the words, but the intention. There was no possibility that Jesus was going to get leprosy. Jesus had been prepared a body that was pre-fall Adamic type body. It wasn't subject to the diseases and all that kind of stuff. His immune system operated at 100% all the time. His body was not affected by sin, the sin of Adam. I don't want you to get the wrong impression here, but Jesus could have wallowed in the germs and the viruses and all of that, and he still wouldn't have gotten sick. Therefore, when he reaches out and touches this leper, he's not breaking any laws. He's not going to get infected. That was the reason for the law. Everybody who saw him do it. But why did he do it? Why did he touch that man? Well, it was, again, one of those things that stretch the observers. they had to decide whether he should have done that or not, based on their understanding of what God has said, and you have to be really careful when you're doing that. So why did Jesus put them in that kind of a pickle? I mean, did they know that God's intention was to prevent infection? If they knew that, why didn't they tell somebody so that 2,000 years later we'd have to figure it out again? Or wouldn't have to figure it out again? I don't think they understood that. So Jesus put them in a bind by violating what they considered to be a law of God. So why did he do it? Well, I think he did it because of the leper, not the watchers. We know from Luke 17 that there were 10 lepers in a certain village, unnamed lepers. And they came to Jesus, but they didn't fall on their faces and beg him. They stood far off and yelled, "Lord, have mercy on us." And he said, "Go show yourselves to the priest and offer the sacrifice for cleansing the leprosy for a testimony to them," just like he told this man. And he didn't touch them at all. He didn't even get close enough. They left. So why did he touch this one? Well, I believe that this is where Jesus is dealing with this man. At this point, he wanted to actually heal him. And I don't mean physically. Jesus didn't have to touch the man to heal him physically. So why did he touch him? Well, I really do think that the touch was part of the proof to the leper that Jesus was willing. Which means he was reaching into that leper's spirit and soul, mind, beyond his body. He was reaching into his spirit and his soul with his hand as he touched him, because he was telling the leper, "I want you well. I want you well beyond your leprosy." Remember, Luke's burden is to generate a huge, earth-shaking, theological shift in the minds of men, and that is that God is gracious. Yahweh is gracious. If Luke 17 makes the point that you can be physically healed without touch, what does the touching mean? Well, what did this guy do that they didn't do? Remember when he healed those 10? 9 of them just kept walking when they discovered they were healed, and only a Samaritan came back to give thanks. That was healing without a touch. In other words, they were physically healed. But I don't think it went any further than that. This man, when Jesus touched him, I believe was healed all the way through, because the touch was the personal communication of Jesus' willingness in his situation at that time. Let me see if I can just bring this home to you. You've got a little 4-year-old running around out on the sidewalk, stumbles over his own feet, falls down, scrapes his knee, and starts to show a little red. Ah! Starts screaming, "You run to mommy." Mommy says, "Back off, back off, back off. You'll be all right, you'll be all right." And that little kid goes scream and cry and carry on. But if he runs to mommy and she grabs him up in her arms and she hugs him, and she dries his tears, and she puts a Band-Aid on his knees, he is all right. He wasn't just told to be all right. And I do think that when Jesus reached out and touched this man, it reached all the way into his soul. It was like being embraced by God, because that's what was happening. So I think that Jesus' response to this leper was twofold. He said all the words. He answered the request verbally. But I think stretching out his hand, he touched him. Probably did the job. So what do we get from this? Jesus isn't here. We don't get touched anymore. Oh, we're going to sing a song here in a minute that says we are, but how does that translate today? Well, because Jesus is not here. But because we have a record of what he acted like when he was here. The challenge for us is to develop our understanding of what he is like and what his attitude toward us is from what we find in this revelation. It is not attached to your experiences. It's attached to what he says. If you compare let's say you're in a bad car wreck and you have all these broken bones and you got to lay up in bed for 6 weeks. You say, oh God, why did this happen to me? I don't want to lay up here for 6 weeks. And you say, well, God must hate me. He must really be mad at me. So you take all your broken bones and your 6 weeks in bed and you put it over here and you put the cross with Jesus hanging on it over here and you look at the two and you say, okay, which one of them tells me the truth about God's attitude toward me? And where did you get that picture of the cross if you didn't get it from here? That's why I say you cannot use your experiences to develop your theology. You have got to use the Word of God to develop it. What if Job had decided that God hated him because of what was happening? He would have never said, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. So I want to encourage you this morning, whatever your circumstances are, granted, some of them are going to be kind of hard, but you don't decide God's attitude toward you based on that. You decide God's attitude toward you based on what he said. Let's pray together. Father, we know that there are issues here that we've not even scratched the surface of, and we know that your interest in us is true according to your word. So we pray this morning that our interaction together with your word today will help as we consider the decisions we make day by day about you and about your attitude toward us in the experiences of our lives. We ask this in Jesus' name.